Back, everybody. On today's blog interview, we're speaking with Ray Klepper. He's a physical therapist and actually a colleague of mine here in Chico, California. Today we're going to talk about a different topic, a little outside of the realm of manual therapy, but certainly important for things that we deal with our patients and ourselves as well. And some of that has to do with diet and lifestyle choices that we make. So Ray, thank you for coming.
Matt, thank you for having me.
Ray, can you first start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I've been a therapist for 5 years now, and my roots are from St. Augustine, which is a manual therapy-oriented program, primarily from Dr. Stanley Paris. And I actually did one of my internship rotations where I'm currently working now and was exposed to another paradigm, the Institute of Physical Art, which I immediately fell in love with and am kind of working toward certification in that. So I would say certainly I am becoming and honing my skills in manual therapy. I've worked an outpatient for the 5 years. I was at a clinic prior to this, also private practice. We saw the gamut of presentations. And I've also taken coursework through the Jones Institute, strain counter strain. I've taken coursework through the Baral Institute with the visceral manipulation series. And myofascial release techniques as well. So kind of eclectic manual therapy approach, but by no means would I consider myself an expert yet. Trying to get better.
Good. Ray, one of the questions that we usually ask people, you know, with our interviews are, how did you make the decision to become a physical therapist, or if, you know, different profession, what influenced you to make that decision? So how did you get interested in physical therapy?
Well, my initial track was actually medical school. And when I was an undergraduate at UC Davis, I was focused on pre-med. My goal was ultimately dermatology. I think it was my junior year, I was studying for my MCATs, and I just got burnt out, and I kind of decided, you know, maybe I should change my major. I kind of bounced around in a few classes and then realized, you know, well, maybe I should just stick with my major and finish it out and then go from there. And one of my classmates had applied to USC to their physical therapy program and was kind of gearing me toward that particular approach. And I had had therapy in the past. I was injured in high school. I had a meniscus lesion, went through physical therapy. So the majority of what I knew was just sports rehab. I didn't know that there was a whole other ball game of physical therapy. And so she said, well, if you get a job as a physical therapy aide or tech and get some experience and see if you like it, go from there. So I immediately jumped on that bandwagon and got a job and loved it. And I had the majority of the prerequisites done because I was in kind of bioscience. And so I applied 2 years later and got into PT school, and the rest is history. Haven't looked back.
Cool. So what, you know, I certainly going to University of St. Augustine and having professors there as an influence into manual therapy. Was there any particular experience that you had either as an aide or a tech or in school or even after school that got you more interested into the manual therapy aspect of physical therapy?
As an aide, I don't think I was really well aware of all of the different paradigms that were out there. For me, it was just my observation skills of, okay, this therapist is, you know, putting their hands on the patient and they're doing some sort of technique. It looks like massage. That's all I knew. And until I was actually in school and exposed to the different types of manual therapy, which I was lucky to at the program that I was in, even prior to going through my internships, you know, we had 2-day lectures on McKinsey and visceral manipulation and STM or soft tissue mobilization and myofascial release. So we were really lucky. So I had this idea of, wow, there's all this other stuff out there besides just, you know, the typical massage type techniques that can make huge changes. And then as I got into the clinic, and again, going back to my internship here at INLO, the IPA's philosophy and Greg Johnson's first soft tissue course and kind of being exposed to their curriculum was mind-blowing and such a much more, I want to say, functional and skilled technique or set of techniques. And at that point, I was just kind of, I was hooked. I was completely obsessed with it.
Yeah.
So I think that's where I really got my niche of wanting to go that route.
That's good to hear. One of the things, well, the main thing that we wanted to speak with you about today was in relation to topic of nutrition, and specifically one of the things that you've become very interested in, and all the different systems within the human body that it can affect, and that is particularly about low carbohydrate, high fat diet. Can you briefly explain to us how you got introduced into that and how you went about learning more about that? And then we can talk about what it is and the different aspects of it.
Sure. I would have to say, I think I first was introduced to different types of diets when I was in my early 20s. At the time, I was experimenting with the Atkins diet. And I want to say I was 21, 22 out of high school. I kind of fell out of athletics. I started to become a little bit heavier. I was still exercising and still, you know, doing what I felt was, you know, the prescribed thing to do to stay healthy. But I wasn't as careful with what I was eating. And I was exposed to this Atkins diet that was supposed to, you know, allow you to lose a lot of weight pretty quickly. And I really first saw it when I was actually in high school. I had a math teacher who was very, very overweight. And between my sophomore and junior year, we had come back from school or from summer vacation. And the first day, I'll never forget this. The first day I was sitting outside of class, and he comes walking out, and the guy had completely transformed his body. I mean, within 3 months, he went from, I want to say, morbidly obese to just this lean individual. And we were just like, what did he do?
Yeah.
And everyone was like, well, he ate a hamburger, but he didn't eat the bun. And he had a steak, but he didn't have potatoes with it. And so I had this idea of, okay, well, that's pretty cool. I mean, yeah, the guy looks great. How does he feel? I never really asked. I didn't want to ask at that time. But so that's when I was first exposed to it. And so when I was in my early 20s, I experimented with it a little bit, and I was fairly successful. But at the time, again, I wasn't really privy to what was going on physiologically. I never went to the doctor, so I never had, you know, my blood metrics checked. I just knew that it worked pretty well. But at the same time, you know, the availability of the foods that we have now, the hyper-palatable foods, has always been there. So it's at the time, I wasn't as disciplined at sustaining that way of eating. So I fell off the bandwagon after 4 or 5 months. Fast forward to now, a couple of years ago, I went and got a life insurance policy and had a very comprehensive workup done. And in the same situation, you know, I was, my blood pressure was a little bit high and I was a little bit overweight. So I knew if I could, you know, lose 10, 15 pounds in a couple of months, I could probably improve my policy premium. And I did that. And when I got my metrics back, it was extremely comprehensive. And I just wondered, what are all these things that they're measuring? And at that point, I got interested in lab values, metrics, and how it was that what I was eating was affecting those things. And so I started to read, and I came across the science behind a low carbohydrate, high fat diet, and the pioneers that were behind that paradigm, which is Dr. Volek and Dr. Finney. And Dr. Finney's actually a professor who has his roots at UC Davis.
Yeah.
And they have been doing this since the 70s. And at the time, they were heretics because then that was when the low-fat diet was kind of beginning to become mainstream because of...
Yeah, really popular.
Yeah, yeah. And cholesterol was a huge issue and heart disease was a huge issue. And if we get into the history there, which we will in a little bit, those guys were shunned, you know, because of what they were doing, and everyone thought they were crazy. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, and even recently, in the short time that I've known you, you blessing or curse, you had plenty of time to read up on these things after a recent injury where you couldn't work for several weeks, and I'm sure you got to learn a lot more during that time too, right?
Yeah, I decided to engage in some recreational activities, and interestingly enough, I knew that for the last 8 or 9 years, why I didn't engage in those activities was the risk of injury, and yet, you know, I was concerned about an ACL or a sprained ankle and missing some work. But this time, it was a fractured radial head. Which put me out 8 weeks. I was non-weight bearing, and fortunately, I was in a position where I was already, I think, in a good place physiologically to withstand an injury like that. So I had very little pain. I had some mechanical dysfunctions and some issues that were treated out, and thankfully to you and a couple other colleagues. But yeah, I had 8 weeks off, so I took it upon myself to spend 40 hours a day, or a week rather, 8 hours a day, probably more, reading and educating myself on as much as I could as it relates to this topic, and trying to look at both sides of the picture too to figure out, well, is one camp low-fat camp, or is one camp, the other camp, low-carb camp? Right or wrong, or are they both right, or what is going on? Because there seems to be a silent, and it's becoming more of an issue,
vocal.
More vocal, of a war. And if you're paying attention to the news, you'll kind of see that now.
Yeah, especially the American Heart Association bashing coconut oil recently. Okay, so having gone through some of those things, can you go ahead and describe to us what is a low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet, and how that might contrast to what has been taught in the past, the food pyramid, and you could even mention other terms for it or similar lifestyles like the Atkins diet or even ketogenic. So can you start with that?
Sure. So low carb is kind of an umbrella term for anything that's probably somewhere around less than 130 grams of total carbohydrate per day.
Which isn't that bad.
I mean, if you track your macros, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you're not eating processed foods, that's ridiculously easy to do.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Standard American diet is about 380 grams of carbohydrate. That's survey based, but I certainly believe it because I was there, and those do add up if you're really not watching it and you're eating a lot of processed foods.
So. Oh yeah, definitely.
But yeah, a low carb is generally less than 130 grams. The Atkins approach is a phasic or a staged approach, and there's an initial induction phase, which is the first few weeks, and that is a fairly ketogenic type approach where your total grams of carbs per day is about less than 20. And then a ketogenic diet, it can be various, but keto typically means, you know, absence of carbohydrate and the upregulation or production of ketones, which are metabolites of fats for energy instead of glucose or the product of carbohydrate metabolism. And so in the induction phase of Atkins, you're generally becoming ketogenic. And then with Atkins traditionally, you would add in carbohydrates gradually, you know, 5 or 6 grams per week until you started to see a change in your weight or how you felt.
And then you would stay below that threshold.
Correct, correct, okay. Yeah. But the problem, too, with Atkins is that when that became popular in the 70s and then again in the early 2000s was that there was a lot of processed, you know, low-sugar Atkins foods
right.
that probably weren't the best things to eat.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, he got a bad rap for that.
Yeah, it didn't help when he died.
No. And there's some misconception there, too, with how he died.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
A lot of people think that he died of a heart attack, but he actually fell ice skating and had a large concussion and a hematoma and eventually passed away from complications,
yeah.
Not because he had an MI. So.
Yeah. Well, with that, you know, that's one question that I've often had people say of, well, what's the difference between low-carb, high-fat, or a ketogenic diet and Atkins diet? And I haven't really been able to answer that question well enough. So with that, are there any other explanations that, you know, we should go over in terms of what that is, low-carb, high-fat, or ketogenic? Or I guess I think the better direction to go now that I'm talking about it would be, can you explain the difference metabolism-wise between eating a traditional American diet or the one that we're talking about, low carbohydrate, high fat?
Sure. So when we talk about fuel sources, we have primarily two. We have glucose or sugar, or we have fatty acids in the form of triglycerides. And a traditional standard American diet, we generally burn glucose for fuel. We have a limited supply to store glucose. We have our liver, which stores glucose in the form of glycogen.
Mm-hmm.
And we have our skeletal muscle tissue, which also stores it as glycogen. And on average, an average male, 5'8", 5'9", like me, 175 pounds, can store about 200 to 300 grams of glucose in total, their liver and their muscle tissue. We have an inability to utilize, once the glucose is in our muscle tissue, for energy outside of that tissue. We don't have any enzymes that can take it out of our muscle tissue and put it back into our bloodstream and then use it for energy elsewhere. But our liver, we can break it down and put it in our bloodstream, and we can get it into our brain or whatever cells we need for energy.
Hmm.
So limited supply. So if we're fueled primarily by glucose, we have a limited supply, and once it's burned up, our cells are going to want to eat again. So hence,
they need more energy.
They need more energy. So
yeah.
That hunger, that roller coaster of if you eat a higher carbohydrate or standard American diet, you're going to be hungry after a couple of hours because you've already utilized all that glucose.
Yeah, that's the blood sugar roller coaster.
That's I mean, the hangry.
Blood sugar, yeah, goes goes up after you eat, and then it tanks, and then you get hungry and hangry.
Yes.
Hungry and angry.
Hungry and angry. Hangry. Yeah. However, on the other hand, in a low-carbohydrate or ketogenic approach where we keep our carbohydrates below roughly 130 grams, some people need less depending upon the person, we can utilize fatty acids for fuel. And in the event that we have gone 8, 10, 12 hours without eating, we can access our stored body fat for fuel instead of having to eat fat or eat something for our cells to eat. So our own fat stores are utilized or upregulated for fuel. Mm-hmm. So we can go for longer periods of time without having to eat or be hungry, and our cells are still eating. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it sounds an awful lot like fasting. Right. Fasting doesn't mean not eating for a week, but it could be, like you said, 12 hours. So, you know, a lot of people, even some of our listeners probably don't like to eat breakfast.
Sure.
You know? So from the time that they finish dinner the night before until the time they eat lunch or even later, that's technically a fast.
Right. And a fast is simply a lack of putting something exogenously into our body. Our body still has stored energy for fuel in our adipose tissue or our fat cells. And that's all our fat cells are. It's just stored energy.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do fast, our body has to have a way to eat in the event of a famine, which essentially is sensing. And we know that, you know, 10, 20,000 years ago, pre-agricultural days, there had to have been famines.
Feast and famine.
We had to have had ways to physiologically survive without having food. So our fat stores are that way of eating without having to actually take in food.
Right.
So fasting is simply just eating our own body fat without having to eat anything exogenously. Now, for some people who aren't or haven't been eating a low-carbohydrate diet for a while and aren't, quote-unquote, fat-adapted, have a tough time initially because they're primarily fueled by sugar. So their hormones haven't switched over to being able to kind of tolerate that, and certainly it can. It just takes a couple of weeks or, you know, up to a month or two. But
can we, just because of what you were just mentioning, can we back up just a little bit, and can you explain, for people who eat the typical Western diet, typical American diet that's high in carbohydrates, on the hormonal level or the other cellular level, what happens in terms of once you run out of that storage space for the glycogen, you know, how it gets stored, you know, insulin levels, things like that. Can you describe that for us real quick?
Absolutely. So if we're talking about a standard American diet, we're relying primarily on glucose for fuel.
And by, sorry to interrupt, by standard American diet, we're talking about the USDA recommended food pyramid, where you have grains and cereals and breads and things like that on the bottom, which should be the majority of your calorie intake. Above that should be fruits and veggies, or next to that should be fruits and veggies in terms of abundance. And then next from that should be dairy and meats. And then at the very top, the last little thing you should have is fat.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
So sorry, I just wanted to reiterate that.
Sorry, and that's what we were taught in PT school 5-6 years ago. And it's actually
still being taught, yeah.
Well, it's my plate now, but it's fairly similar in terms of macros.
Right.
And, you know, if you kind of look at government subsidies, you know, they're largely subsidizing corn, wheat, and soy.
Oh, certainly.
But if we go into the metabolism of a standard American diet and a diet that's primarily fueled by glucose, we're relying on hormones to take in that glucose into our cells and get it out of the bloodstream as quick as possible. Any prolonged exposure in our bloodstream to glucose causes glycation, or a non-enzymatic spontaneous chemical reaction that damages lipoproteins, which are large proteins that carry cholesterol. It damages our endothelium, which is the outer lining of our blood vessels. So our body has to keep our blood glucose between 70 and 100 milligrams per deciliter. That's vital. And in order to do that, it will do whatever it has to do to keep it that way, at the expense of our pancreas secreting gallons and gallons of insulin to mitigate the amount of glucose we're taking in. And something that never, ever gets measured in the doctor's office is fasting insulin.
Yeah, so this is different than the typical measurements of fasting glucose.
Correct.
And this is not even including the A1C levels.
Correct.
We're talking about something totally different, which is insulin, fasting insulin.
Right. Okay.
How much insulin is in your bloodstream when you're in a fasting state?
Right. And there's an equation that you can have if you have basically a fasting glucose and a fasting insulin. And it's a very specific and sensitive equation to measure the amount of insulin your body needs at any given time in a fasted state to keep your blood glucose normal. And it's called HOMA-IR. It's the homeostatic model of insulin resistance. And the higher the number, or anything above 1.25, is considered insulin resistant, which is a measure of our body's overproduction of insulin to cover the amount of glucose that we're taking in, right, to get it out of our bloodstream.
So can you explain to our listeners, you know, insulin resistance? You know, we're not talking about diabetes, but how does that differ from diabetes, and does that eventually lead to diabetes? Because it sounds a lot like, you know, like you're saying the hormone insulin and blood sugar levels at any given time. So can you kind of explain those things?
Sure, absolutely. So I think of diabetes as a spectrum. And you often hear the term pre-diabetes, diabetes, etc. And oftentimes, you know, you'll ask a patient, are you diabetic? They'll say, well, no, I'm pre-diabetic. I'm not there yet. Well, it's just a spectrum. And what they're measuring is either a hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of how much damage hemoglobin they have from that glycation or that glucose damaging the hemoglobin molecule over a three-month period. And the lab values will show that if you are above 5.6% to 6.4%, you're considered pre-diabetic. And 6.5 and up, you're considered diabetic.
Hmm.
You can also define diabetes as an impaired fasting glucose or something that's above that standard range of 70 to 100 or 110, depending upon your lab value.
Hmm.
And when we talk about insulin resistance, we're talking about cellular resistance to the hormone insulin. So someone may have a normal fasting glucose. They may have a within normal limits hemoglobin A1C, but they may have a collection of metabolic metrics called metabolic syndrome,
mm-hmm.
or a cluster of findings that are aberrant, such as a low HDL, something mm-hmm. below 40. A high blood triglyceride, which means that the triglycerides are in the blood, they're just not being used for energy, which is typically above 140. A large abdominal girth or right. visceral fat, and a myriad of other collection of metrics. When you have three or four of those, you're considered to have metabolic syndrome, and we know that that is also in the literature called insulin resistance syndrome.
Hmm.
So you're resistant to the hormone insulin, meaning your cells aren't responding to it as well. So in order to keep that glucose normal, your pancreas is working overtime by producing more insulin to get that glucose out of the bloodstream and into the cells, because that is the most important thing. If we go too high or too low, we're going to have a problem.
Right.
So it'd be better to have an insulin problem short term than it would be to have a blood glucose problem short term. But the long-term effects, which we'll get to in a second, on hyperinsulinemia or insulin resistance,
mm-hmm.
is even worse.
Yeah, and that sounds basically like a downward spiral where your body is churning out so much insulin to get rid of the excess glucose that, like you're saying, it becomes more resistant to it. So it has to churn out even more insulin, and
exactly.
it just kind of keeps going and going and going to where it essentially, after a while, it doesn't do its job at all anymore, and then you become diabetic.
Exactly.
So what were you going to allude to with the insulin resistance and the even worse effects long-term?
Well, if we look at the standard of care for diabetes, and we visit, let's say, the American Diabetes Association's website, we peruse the website and we find a number of things. First and foremost, on the front is a large logo for Merck. Merck is a pharmaceutical company that largely produces insulin. And the ADA's definition of type 2 diabetes, which is insulin independent diabetes, meaning that an individual is producing insulin, they're just not responding to it as well as they should, is such that they have a disease that is progressive and will eventually get worse, and they will probably eventually require insulin.
Mm-hmm.
And the standard of care for that particular pathology is a meal that consists of 45 grams of carbohydrate per meal. So if one eats 45 to 60 grams of carbohydrate per meal per day, you're looking at a minimum of 135 grams, which is at the very top end of a low carbohydrate diet. But we all know that most people are probably eating double that.
Right, because that's why they're in that situation.
Exactly.
And what the ADA recommends is actually less than what they're more than likely consuming.
Yes. So you have a situation where you have a health organization that is sponsored by a pharmaceutical company that sells insulin, and you have this cycle. And one has to wonder how much the two are influencing each other and how much of a conflict of interest there is. And at the same time, do these health organizations truly have the patient's health in mind?
Yeah.
And nowhere do they acknowledge the benefits of a low carbohydrate diet when in the research it is more effective at reducing the amount of insulin needed, reducing hemoglobin A1C, and even reversing the pathology of type 2 diabetes because of that relationship that they have with big food and big pharma.
Well, go back to the long-term effects of being insulin resistant. Describe that more for us, since that's what we were talking about before. So we're saying how the body would sacrifice its insulin and the pancreas, as an example, in the short term to make sure that the more important thing, blood glucose levels, are within a normal range. So what happens long term if that keeps going on over years or decades?
Sure. So what we're talking about is a short-term solution to a long-term problem. meaning the body will overproduce insulin to keep blood glucose as normal as possible. So we're talking about trying to maintain homeostasis, which the body does a fantastic job of. But what happens is, as the cells become more resistant to insulin, primarily our hepatocytes, our liver, our adipocytes, our fat cells, and our skeletal muscle tissue, is that stuff gets stuck in the bloodstream, and it can't be used.
Stuff meaning glucose?
Stuff meaning glucose, triglycerides.
Triglycerides, which are the body's fat energy.
Right, and they're not... Triglycerides get a bad rap because we think of triglycerides as being atherogenic, and they can be if they're stuck. But if you're eating in such a way that you utilize them for energy, then they're getting cleared out of the bloodstream fast enough to where they're not becoming atherogenic or artery clogging, if you will. And then when we talk about LDL, HDL, we're talking about lipoproteins, larger molecules that carry cholesterol and triglycerides. Mm-hmm. So if we think of a cruise ship, the cruise ship is the LDL molecule, the low-density lipoprotein.
Mm-hmm.
And on the cruise ship, there are life rafts, right? And the life rafts are the cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
And also on the cruise ship are the people. And the people are the triglycerides. So we're talking about a large molecule that carries energy and cholesterol, which is primarily utilized for cell membrane rigidity and repair when we have inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And we can get into that in a minute as far as what the true role of cholesterol is. But we have this reduction in clearance of these molecules because of resistance to insulin. And as a result, we get a reduction in overall clearance of that molecule, and it's just stuck in our bloodstream. And as a result, it causes inflammation.
Well, what gets stuck in our bloodstream?
So, LDL.
LDL.
Low-density lipoprotein.
Mm-hmm.
Serum triglycerides, or triglycerides that are bound to proteins that can cause inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And glucose.
Okay.
If you're full-blown diagnosed diabetic. So when that happens, we have these molecules being exposed over a prolonged period of time to the inner lining of our blood vessels, our endothelium.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates endothelial lesions or inflammation.
Right.
As a result, our immune system is woken up. Macrophages are called to the site. A foam cell is formed, and ironically, cholesterol is called to help repair the lesion.
Because that's its job.
Because that's its job.
Yeah.
It's like if a house is on fire and someone calls 911 and the firemen show up and they're trying to put out the fire, they're there, they're at the scene of the crime, but they didn't start the fire. They're trying to clear it up.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So just because plaque has cholesterol in it doesn't mean cholesterol caused the plaque.
Right.
It's there to repair
right.
the endothelium. And in fact, there's a process called endocytosis, where the cells of the endothelium will actually engulf or take in the entire LDL particle.
Hmm.
So the whole cargo ship, including the triglycerides and the cholesterol, if needed, to repair that cell. So when we look at cholesterol, our body makes it. It's a natural endogenous molecule.
Mm-hmm.
We rarely absorb what we eat, which has been proven and written in many of the health organizations that just haven't come out and said it. But it's there.